Advocates for children cheer as Tallahassee makes moves to start to reform Florida's juvenile justice system. Good Tuesday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and through our app. Just ahead, why Florida could revamp the way it treats juveniles in our state's criminal justice system. You can get on the line now. Be part of the conversation here on the show at 549-2937. Then later, today's movable feast is matching wine with music. Plus, actress Jane Atkinson Gill from the Netflix hit House of Cards. Find out why she's in town this week. All of that ahead and more. But first this hour, a bill is making its way through the Florida legislature right now, and it could reform radically the way kids are treated in this state's juvenile justice system. Now, the measure would put much stricter limits on when and how juveniles can be tried as adults. You might not realize that Florida is one of just 15 states that allows prosecutors to just unilaterally decide to charge a child as an adult. That process is called direct filing. But a proposed new law that just passed a state Senate committee would permit the child's lawyers to challenge a direct file, and it would give some discretion to the judge in the case. This is all part of a bipartisan push in Florida to reform the juvenile justice system. And there are a lot of moving parts here and a number of bills making their way through the state legislature right now. Attorney Rob Mason is director of the Juvenile Division with the Office of the Public Defender, 4th Judicial Circuit. That's here in our corner of the state. And he joins us now in studio. Hey, Rob, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Do you think kids should never be tried as adults? Do you think that there are times when they should be? What are your thoughts about moves to reform Florida's juvenile justice system? There's widespread bipartisan agreement in Florida that changes need to be made. We want your calls. We want to know what you think. So give us a call right now. The number to join the show is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets go to @MelissaInJax. And you can weigh in on our Facebook page as well. And so, Rob, Senate Bill 936, as it's labeled, passed the Senate Criminal Justice Committee this week, 5-1. And this is due to the work of a coalition and a nonprofit group called No Place for a Child, trying to reduce the number of kids in this state charged as adults. This is a big victory for this coalition, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly a starting point. And it's one thing that everyone needs to realize is we're trying to change the process. Many times opponents of this type of reform will state that we're being soft on crime. No, we're trying to restore judicial authority to make the decision. Again, as you mentioned, there's only 15 states that even allow prosecutors to do this. And of those 15 states, 12 of them allow you to challenge it at the adult level after the prosecutor's direct filed to see if you could get it sent back to juvenile. We don't even have that. So there's basically 47 states that have less discretion with the prosecutors than what we have.
And in fact, people might not realize that Florida charges more juveniles as adults than any other state. And 98% of the time, it's because the prosecutor makes a unilateral decision to direct file, as it's called, a case and charge a minor as an adult. And isn't it most often for a violent crime?
No.
Not always.
Not always. There's a lot of non-personal crimes. There's property crimes. The situation is so bad that the Human Rights Watch, an international watchdog, came to Florida and did a report on direct file in 2014. And that's where the 98% comes, because you can be sent to adult court via indictment, which there's no age limit, meaning a 7-year-old could be indicted. And I bring that up because a 7-year-old in Miami was arrested the other day for tussling with one of their teachers. You can also go to adult court via waiver, which means the juvenile judge, there's a hearing, the juvenile judge believes it's appropriate to send the case up to the adult level. That's not being changed.
This measure would give the judge in juvenile court more discretion, basically, in the case, more of a say in how the case is adjudicated?
Not so much the juvenile judge, because the law is not changing on these waiver hearings. Any child 14 years or older, if they didn't qualify for direct file, the state could file a motion and there could be a waiver hearing. What it does is it gives the judges the power at the adult level. So once a case is transferred at the adult level, then that judge would have some more authority.
And so what would be an example of that? Give me an example of what a judge in adult court could do to mitigate in a case where a juvenile is before the judge.
Well, the starting point is the fitness hearing, which in some places around the country, they call that a reverse waiver. But what that would mean is if a child is direct filed and goes from juvenile court to the adult court, a fitness hearing could be conducted where basically you could challenge whether a child should be prosecuted as an adult. So the court would have an ability, the judge at the adult level, to send a case back to juvenile before a plea or before an adjudication.
It's 549-2937. As we look at efforts in Tallahassee underway now to reform Florida's juvenile justice system, Florida tries more juveniles as adults than any other state in the form of direct filing. As we talk with Rob Mason of the Florida Fourth Circuit Public Defender's Office, what are your questions about this? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. And of course, Rob, people in this circuit, Northeast Florida, who followed the notorious case of a juvenile named Christian Fernandez, know about this because it played a role in the ouster of our former state attorney, Angela Corey, and the election of our current state attorney, Melissa Nelson. That case and some others. Christian was 12, 13 when he was charged as an adult with the homicide of his sibling. Angela Corey faced not only national criticism, but international condemnation over that case. Under Melissa Nelson, direct filing of kids as adults has plummeted, and she's received a lot of praise for the different direction she's taken the prosecutor's office in the way she handles these juvenile cases. And so you can look at that example of the Fourth Circuit as one way in which there's bipartisan support for recognizing that kids are different and kids should be handled in a different manner.
Right. And Melissa Nelson and her administration deserves a lot of praise for how they're handling juveniles. But what's also important is it's not just the numbers of children that get prosecuted as adults, but there's been a change in this administration with Ms. Nelson as to the leverage that is used. Because under the 8 years of Angela Corey, there were cases where children essentially had to plead guilty and be subject to pretty severe juvenile sanctions, or they were going to be prosecuted as adults. And that's not a good measure. That's not a good way to handle things. And that procedure has been dramatically lessened with the new administration.
Now, the Senate Criminal Justice Committee is looking at a series of reforms, not just this particular measure. There's more support, I think it's fair to say, in the state Senate for criminal justice reform in Florida than there is in the Florida House, which is certainly more conservative, more ideological. So how challenging do you see this political landscape, Rob Mason, when you look at the push to reform our state's criminal justice system, particularly for minors, as the legislative session progresses? Because any of these measures have to get through both chambers before they reach the governor's desk.
Well, it is very challenging. And 2 years ago, we had legislation that got through three Senate committees unanimously, but we could not even get it calendared for the first House committee. There is a companion House bill, House Bill 509. It has not been calendared yet, and it is a challenge, but I think that as time progresses, I think more and more of the country becomes bipartisan on this. More and more of the groups look and see that it makes more sense to be smart on crime instead of tough on crime, because sometimes being tough on crime leads to higher recidivism. And that's what happens. There's studies that show that children that get prosecuted as adults recidivate sooner and more seriously.
This issue and infrastructure investment, I think, are probably the only two issues that come to my mind anyway, where you see bipartisan majorities in favor right now. Let's go to some calls now for Rob Mason of the Public Defender's Office as we talk about what's happening in the legislative session. It's happening now in Tallahassee as the Senate, anyway, is looking at ways to reform Florida's criminal justice system, particularly the juvenile justice system. What are your thoughts on trying kids as adults and the way Florida leads the nation in many respects in direct filing? That's the process where the state's prosecutors make a decision to try juveniles as adults. This legislation that's moving through would reduce that. What do you think about this? 549-2937. Maria out in Intercoastal West. Hey, Maria, good morning. What are your thoughts?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We come from what I would consider a family that doesn't have legal problems. And my 19-year-old son got involved in fraudulent medical injury claims as a result of car insurance. There was a large scam in the area a couple of years ago, and he was charged as an adult with this felony charge. And since then, he has had trouble finding housing. He's had trouble finding jobs. It's limited what he's been able to do. He comes from a good family. He had a lot of support to make sure this didn't happen again. And what we learned is how saddling young people, juveniles, young adults, with this kind of record just really hampers their ability to move forward with any kind of constructive, protective, or productive life in our communities. So I feel very strongly about restructuring how this is handled so that they aren't labeled and channeled into crime or just, you know, riding on the back of society because they can't get a job or find somewhere to live.
Thanks for that, Maria. And certainly the nonprofit No Place for a Child has been trying to carry that message in the state capitol that kids are different. They certainly have more propensity to rehabilitate. They are a burden for life with an adult felony conviction if they are not given the chance to make things right while they're still minors. That's certainly your argument, isn't it, Rob?
Oh, absolutely. And there's been an over-criminalization for juveniles. When I was a child, you had to really do a very serious offense to be arrested. If you did something dumb, like hop on a golf cart, like my sister and myself, and take a little joyride on the golf cart, you were lectured. They talked to your parents. You were not arrested because they knew that you were a child. We've changed, especially since the 1990s, so that any violation of the law, there seems to be this presumption that we must make an arrest, which I think is incorrect.
Now, when you look at noplaceforachild.com, the website, the coalition and the nonprofit working on this, they're arguing passionately to, in their words, restore the role of judges to decide whether a child should be prosecuted as an adult, pointing out that kids as young as 8 years old in this state have been tried in adult court, that more than 7,600 minors have been prosecuted as adults in Florida since 2011, 98% of them transferred to adult court without any input or oversight by a judge. How did we get to this state of affairs in Florida where the prosecutor is the sole arbiter of this?
Well, most of the laws that have allowed the prosecutors this much power came from the early 90s. And that was a particularly bad time for juveniles because there was this theory of the super predator. There was this theory that kids are worse now than they've ever been, and it's just going to be complete chaos. Now, the proponents and the people that put forth that theory have admitted years ago that, whoops, my bad, sorry, that's not correct. But what happened was in the early 90s, we had some high-profile cases involving juveniles, and that's why the laws changed. The laws keep getting, generally they kept getting stronger and gave the prosecutors more power, and that's how we wound up where we are now.
Now, Melissa Nelson's office, it won't comment on pending legislation, although certainly her track record on this is clear and it's been reported on quite extensively. But let's get inside the head of the prosecutor, since you're usually, as the public defender, on the other side of the table from them. What would you say to some of the prosecutors around the state who, while they might concede that there have been excesses, that there are some violent juveniles in this state who have committed violent crimes and deserve to face serious consequences? They say they can make the justification for adult charges in some cases.
And again, this does not eliminate all children going to adult court. It limits who the prosecutors can send up automatically. But any of the cases that don't qualify to be sent up, the prosecutors can still challenge and try to get the juvenile court judge to send it up. So whenever people talk about there's some really bad crimes and some kids that do terrible things, those cases can still be prosecuted at the adult level. We're just hoping there's due process, and we're hoping that it's very deliberate and that a lot of attention is paid to the case.
Let's go to some of your calls right now. As we look at the effort to reform Florida's juvenile justice system, our state sends more kids to adult court than any other, according to the nonprofit No Place for a Child. They're lobbying for reforms of the system right now as the state legislative session meets in Tallahassee. Natalie in World Golf Village. Hey, Natalie, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
My primary question would be, what is the advantage to prosecuting a child as an adult? It surprises me, after hundreds of years of psychological research, we know that the brain is not fully developed in a child, so they lack the executive functioning of an adult as well as the midbrain self-regulation. So it surprises me that we would choose this angle, and I don't see it advantageous to the child or to society.
Thanks, Natalie. And that's certainly the argument that advocates on your side of the issue have been making for years now.
It is, and we need to realize how much of an outlier we are, not just in Florida, but what our country does with juveniles. It's not done like that in other parts of the world, the vast majority. And they look at the United States juvenile justice system and they're just aghast by what we do.
So the U.S. is an outlier around the developed Western world, and Florida is an outlier in the U.S., is what you're saying.
Yes.
Is what I hear you saying.
Yes.
Okay. Megan at the Beaches. Hello, Megan.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if this legislation is retroactive at all, if it would affect any juveniles that have already been prosecuted as adults in the juvenile system.
Is the legislation retroactive, Megan asks.
No, it is not. Sadly, yeah. It is not.
Yeah. So this would affect future cases. And as you've pointed out, Rob, this is gaining support in the state Senate, but the process now goes to the House, where certainly there will be a lot choppier waters, let's say. What's the legal strategy, or not the legal strategy, but the political strategy as advocates for this move to the House, the State House of Representatives?
Well, I think it's like any other legislation that tries to get pushed through. There's going to be some give and take. Right now, the Senate bill, the committee substitute Senate bill 936 is a pretty strong bill. Whether it can maintain the integrity of what's in there right now, that's probably, you know, that may not happen in light of the fact of what has to happen to get individual legislation through various committees at both the Senate and the House.
Jennifer emails the show, as one who has had experience handling cases in the juvenile justice system as an attorney in another state, I am opposed to this bill because I think it doesn't go far enough. What we need is a system where the prosecutor has to file a motion to transfer the case to adult court and argue the motion to the judge. No more direct filing. It is obviously being overused, and prosecutorial discretion needs to be reined in. Agree or disagree?
Agree. And I also want to tell the listeners that with the Constitutional Revision Commission, that there was a proposition, Proposition 73, that was being pushed that essentially stated that a judge had to make the decision. But sadly, that was voted down last week.
That's the commission that meets once every 20 years and looks at changes to the state constitution.
Yes.
Okay. Here's a tweet from Sivar. I do not believe there should be any exception where a child could be charged as an adult. Any exception given to prosecutors will just be used as leverage against kids. On our Facebook page, Paula writes, that's our First Coast Connect Facebook page, nobody under the age of 16 should be tried as an adult. It smacks of the medieval age. All right, let's go to Auden. Auden, is that your name on the south side? Hey, Auden, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Aiden. Good morning, Aiden.
Hey, how are you? Enjoy your show. Just wanted to tell a quick story about myself when I was younger. We've been talking about, or you guys have been talking about, children being prosecuted as adults and how, you know, that relates to the judicial system and the prosecutors taking that into their own hands. I had a quick question when it relates to police. My story was I came here when I was 12, about 12 years old, to the United States, to Jacksonville, Florida. And I lived in Germany beforehand. And it's a very stark difference with the police in and of itself. I remember when we were about 10 or 11, we went to a electronics store. And we decided to steal 3 or 4 video games, and we were never successful because they really caught us right then and there at the store. But instead of taking us to jail or trying us as adults or teenagers, they kind of took us to the police station, called our parents, and told them, "Hey, pick up your children. We caught them stealing video games. We're not going to do anything because we weren't criminals." So I guess my question is, what if you started with, you know, police enforcement to begin with? With, you know, in using judgment instead of just, you know, kind of changing the system or trying to decide whether this is in the prosecutor's hands or not, why not just kind of nip it in the butt beforehand? And I'll take my comments off here. Thank you.
Aiden, thank you. And of course, local activists have been urging the state attorney's office to do that in the form of something called, I think it's a civil citation, correct? Rather than prosecuting a juvenile for a minor shenanigans or a misdemeanor, issuing something called a civil citation.
That's correct. And the police always have discretion not to arrest.
Right.
So that's a future show on First Coast Connect with Sheriff Williams.
Sure. And I think the sheriff has talked about that actually on this show, how they are working on those issues, community policing, their Shadco chapters and such. And I appreciate that call from Aiden. Here's an email from Catherine. Please address the issue as well of the increase in the money in private juvenile and adult prison facilities. There may be a push to fill those facilities. Now, there is also legislation, Rob, before the state Senate that would bring more oversight into the private companies that operate some 53 residential facilities for juveniles under contract with the Department of Juvenile Justice, 53 residential facilities in the state run by private companies. And so what about that aspect of this? And Catherine's concerned that, hey, there's a profit motive. They need juvenile bodies in those facilities to make money.
And there's a great documentary called Kids for Cash on that, about a scandal up in Lucerne County in Pennsylvania. The Department of Juvenile Justice had been cutting beds because they had been looking at more empirical evidence and they've been looking at more evidence-based practices. So beds were being cut from these facilities, and the results are that we actually have a, a shortage of beds right now, and we have you have to await in secure detention before being placed into your residential program.
So in the meantime, we'll continue to follow the progress of these measures. As always, we appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks so much.
Rob Mason with the Fourth Circuit Public Defender's Office leading their juvenile division. Much more still ahead later, a look ahead to Made in St. Augustine, where you can sample some of the delights of the nation's oldest city. That's coming up soon. But up next, our movable feast on the show pairs wines with the symphony. We'll tell you about it right after this.
Calling all educators. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach.
We've updated the WJCT app to make it even better. Stay up to date with local and national NPR news from your phone or tablet. Listen live to First Coast Connect or any of your favorite radio programs. Stay connected and informed. Download the WJCT app today. Available at the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, music and wine are always a great pairing as long as it's the right mix. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and hospitality trends around the region, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with Bill Mallets about the upcoming Wines for Music event with the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra at Marsh Landing Country Club.
Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too.
This is Lee Court thinking about how lucky we are in Jacksonville to have an incredible Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. And at the beaches, we have an amazing organization called Brass. And this morning, I'm happy to be here with Bill Mallets, who is going to talk with us about Brass, what it means, and what's coming up for fundraising for our Jacksonville Symphony. Good morning, Bill. Thank you for being with me.
Good morning, Lee. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you share from the beginning the letters Brass? What does Brass mean?
Brass is a very clever acronym. Of course, when you think of brass, you might think of the brass section of the symphony. But what it really stands for, the letters stand for, is Beaches Resonance Actively Supporting the Symphony. So it's meant to be a group of neighborhoods on the beach, Ponte Vedra Beach, Atlantic Beach, Neptune Beach, Jacksonville Beach,
well,
all up and down that area.
That our 40-mile island that doesn't have a name.
That's right.
The 40-mile island that's comprised of 5 different beach communities.
Right.
When was Brass begun?
About 27 years ago, well before my time in this area. I just joined the Brass board earlier this year, so I'm a bit of a rookie in the organization, although I've been to their events. I'm an active symphony goer. I love the music, and I think you're absolutely right that it's a gem. It is a cultural gem in Jacksonville to have the quality symphony that we do. And a lot of people in the Beaches area are active attenders, lovers of music, as I am, and happy to support this organization that does raise some significant funds.
We sure do.
For the symphony.
We do. And some of the funding that is raised, and I've recently learned that over the past few years only, we've donated almost $500,000 to the symphony from events that we have planned in the Beaches with brass.
Yeah, that's right. We have some very successful fundraising events that have a long history in terms of it's an annual event, and the first one of those is actually coming up in February, something that we call Wines for Music.
Ah, the connection to Movable Feast.
That's right.
Wines, W-I-N-E-S, for
right.
Music.
Right.
What's the genesis of that? How did that begin?
Well, again, I'm not quite sure how it began, but I've been to a few of them before, and we're now organizing the one that will occur on Sunday, February 25th, at the Marsh Landing Country Club. And it's a kind of a fun event because there are a fairly large number of wine-related auction items offered up. And there is both a silent auction where you can walk around the various tables and see the items and decide whether you want to make a bid on a piece of paper. And then at the end, there's also a live auction of about 10 items.
Uber focused on wine.
Yes.
We don't offer many other auction items except vintage and unique wines that have been donated by very generous people.
That's right. And we do have in the Beaches area generally some folks that really love music and the symphony and have very fine wine collections. And they have been very generous offering some really high quality premium wines at this auction, and
to me, I want to mention one of the things that I've recognized over the years that we have been fans and supporters of brass. That every time there's a brass event, the generosity of our musicians who work and play in the symphony appear.
Yes, they do, and at this event, the upcoming event, the Wines for Music. There will be a small ensemble of some of the musicians from the symphony. And
conductors.
And conductors, right.
This year, on February 25th, how does somebody find out about brass? If they live at the Beaches or if they want to support brass and the symphony through a fun event. You don't have to live at the beach to attend Wines for Music.
That's for sure.
How do they find you?
I think the website is brassonline.org. So that would have a listing of the events and the details about the Wine for Music event. There will be a broad-based mailing going out in the next week or so with a save the date card just to highlight the upcoming event so people can get it on their calendars. And probably early January, we'll have another broad-based mailing of a more detailed invitation with a response card in it.
Well, for those people in the Jacksonville, North Florida area, it's really a treat to know that we have people and organizations on the fringe of Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra downtown who really care and want to keep a healthy organization, no matter your age, no matter your taste of the pops or the holiday events or the classical music or the afternoon learn and coffees.
There's a lot of activity going on in and around the symphony, and I must say, when we were looking for, I was raised in up in the Northeast, retired about 10 years ago, and when we were looking for a place to live, came down here, rented a place, and the fact that there was such a high-quality cultural life here, including the symphony and the Kummer and many other organizations, was a big-time factor in getting us comfortable with moving into this area for our retired life.
It's a great enrichment. And as we enter the new year of 2018, it's wonderful to know that brass is here and we can reach out and be a part of it. So I will see you at the wine auction. I may not be outbidding you, but I know I'll be having as great a time with everybody else. Thank you, Bill Mallets, Brass, brassonline.org, and see you at the symphony.
I look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.
Thanks for that, Lee. Well, fans of the Netflix original series House of Cards were left hanging, and they literally gasped out loud. I know I did. When the character of Secretary of State Kathy Durant was pushed down the stairs at the White House at the end of one episode by scheming Frank Underwood, played, of course, by Kevin Spacey. Take a listen.
Look, Kathy, I respect you. We wouldn't have lasted as long together if I didn't.
My husband's waiting for me.
But you're going to be made to look a fool.
There's no need to insult me, Francis.
Witness after witness is going to rebut whatever you have to say.
My testimony is what it is. It'll all be resolved in the court of public opinion.
Yes, but who's the public going to believe? You or explosive residue on a terrorist computer? Look, Kathy, your testimony is going to seem petty and vengeful. And then where's that going to leave you? What prospects?
It's too late.
You need to take a fall.
Excuse me.
Look, the committee is just going to have to wait. In 2 weeks, it's going to be over anyway, and you're going to be on the wrong side of this thing.
Well, we'll see.
Yes, we will. After you.
But I meant what I said, Kathy.
Kathy. Kathy.
Help! Help! The secretary has fallen!
That Frank Underwood. Oh! Amazing show, and that was a pretty scary scene. Luckily, though, the award-winning actress who portrayed the Secretary of State on House of Cards is just fine. She's happy, healthy, and she's supporting Jacksonville's own volunteers in medicine. Yes, actress Jane Atkinson-Gill will serve as MC for the Women with Heart Luncheon, presented by Florida Blue. It's coming up next Wednesday, February 7th, at the Florida Blue Conference Center. Jane is renowned for her roles on House of Cards, 24, roles on Broadway, and many other star turns. And we're thrilled to have her in town. We have a preview. She's on the line right now. Jane Atkinson-Gill, a pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well. I'm glad you didn't break any bones in that scene, by the way.
No, I didn't break any bones, but I did something kind of silly. I let myself they put down a mat, so I threw myself onto a mat about 12 times to get the illusion that I was actually falling down the stairs, and I woke up very sore the next day.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was very convincing and so chilling. Now,
yes.
You're such an amazing actress. You were so great on House of Cards, and you kind
Thank
of,
you.
You're great as politician in politician roles. You're playing the vice president now on Madam Secretary on CBS.
Correct.
Which is so exciting. And you're going to be emceeing the Women with Heart Luncheon at Volunteers in Medicine's event next week. Full disclosure, I'm one of the Women with Heart for Volunteers in Medicine, but so is your sister. So that's why you're coming
to... Danny Atkinson.
Yeah, so that's why you're coming to town. That's pretty exciting for your family.
It is, and it's wonderful for my sister, Danny. She does a lot of volunteer work, and she certainly is a woman with heart.
How did she get involved in her career, and you ended up being an actress?
Honestly, she really had no interest in being an actress. She has a beautiful singing voice. But being on stage and the rehearsals and doing all of that was just not her cup of tea. We all did The Sound of Music at the Hollywood Playhouse years and years and years ago. And she was bored. She just didn't want, she's just got to keep moving and do different things. And when you do a play or a musical, you do the same thing over and over again. But she has a beautiful singing voice. And so she's an entertainer in that way, But she just, that was just not her thing.
Sure. And it's really exciting to have an actress with your credits hosting this event, Jane, for Volunteers in Medicine. Of course, they do amazing work in the community. What they do is help people in this area who have jobs but simply can't afford health insurance. And this is a way to really shine light on that issue. Is that something that I'm sure that they've brought you into sort of the, you know, the ups and downs of that problem in America? So it'll be great to have you talk about that as well.
Yes. I mean, it's not just for my sister, but I really love their mission statement, you know, providing insurance for the people that are sort of falling through the cracks in the system. And it's a volunteer clinic run almost entirely by volunteer professionals. It's also a teaching clinic, which is wonderful for our up-and-coming doctors and nurses. And I just think that fulfilling this need is a wonderful mission for Volunteers in Medicine. I would love to see this as a model around the country, actually.
Sure, and an easy way people can support this is just by coming out to the luncheon. It's February.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's February 7th at Florida Blue. People can learn more at the Volunteers in Medicine website. That's vim-jax.org. Your sister, Dani Atkinson, is one of the women with heart. There are 12, one for every month of the year, and all of us will spend a month wearing this incredible diamond necklace for a month. And when people ask us about the necklace, well, that gives us a chance to talk about Volunteers in Medicine, which is a cool thing.
Right. But, so for each month, it generates a tremendous awareness for Volunteers in Medicine and also creates the opportunity to raise the needed funds for the clinic.
Now,
it's the second year of this.
Sure. Now, getting back to Hollywood, Jane, you've been on lots of shows, The X-Files, Gossip Girl, The Good Wife. You're on Madam Secretary right now. House of Cards.
I was on Criminal Minds for 8 years.
Criminal Minds. Which role do people come up and ask you about the most? I'm just curious.
Mostly, since House of Cards, that's been the most prevalent. But honestly, consistently over the years, it's been Criminal Minds. And before Criminal Minds, it was 24. Because when I went on to 24, it was extremely popular.
Yeah.
And that was very exciting. But Criminal Minds, you wouldn't believe the amount of people who watch Criminal Minds and were very, well, they were very anti my character, and then they were very sad when I died. And for those of you that haven't gotten to that yet, I'm sorry, I should have said spoiler alert. But I never say it because sometimes people haven't gotten that far. But I actually was killed by Luke Skywalker.
Mark Hamill. Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Well, she'll be alive and well in Jacksonville next week. Jane Atkinson Gill, a pleasure. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Yeah. Take care. And also, I just wanted to do a little plug for the brass because my father sang.
Almost out of time, Jane. Out of time.
Okay. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you at the event for Women with Heart, Volunteers in Medicine.
Yeah, that's coming up next Wednesday, February 7th at the Florida Blue campus, vim-jax.org, to get your ticket. And we'll be right back.
The State of the Union Address.
We must look not only at where we are and where we're going, but where we've been.
In the words of our founders, to form a more perfect union.
They've done so during periods of prosperity and tranquility. And they've done so in the midst of war.
Our resolve is firm and our union is strong.
It's President Trump's turn Tuesday. Live coverage from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on WJCT Public Television and here on 89.9.
One in every five jobs in America is held by a worker under contract. Within a decade, contractors and freelancers could easily make up half of those working. And no matter what job, we will all be affected by the rise of the independent workforce. Together with our NPR colleagues, we'll look at how all of this is ending what we've grown to understand as the world of work.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on a chapter of paranoia and persecution in America, in which the president, Congress, the courts, and the press all played a part. We'll talk with journalist Glenn Frankel, whose book is about the Hollywood blacklist and the making of the classic film High Noon. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Think about Pittsburgh today. Now think about it in the middle of the last century.
It was one of the most vibrant and influential black communities in all of America.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The rise and economic fall of what was called Black Pittsburgh. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's an event to highlight some of the wonderful things that come out of St. Augustine. You've seen them every time you visit the nation's oldest city, from handcrafts to great food, drink, and more. The Made in St. Augustine Festival is coming up Sunday, February 11th at Francis Field. Tickets are only $5. That's the best ticket in town. Festival co-creators Monica Bernthal and Jacqueline Zeichner are here to tell us all about it. Ladies, thanks for coming on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
All right. So this is a really celebration of the local delights of St. Augustine, one of my favorite places. Tell us about it, Monica. How did this all come about? What's going to be happening?
Well, we wanted to create a festival that, you know, truly showcased everything the nation's oldest city has to offer. You know, we started, it was a little bit self-serving. You know, we wanted to try all of the amazing restaurants and bars, and we wanted to discover our local makers who, you know, may not have storefronts. We wanted to shop locally and support our local economy, and wanted to learn more about the area's history, cultural, and natural resources. And we want to take advantage of all the services and opportunities available in our backyard. You know, with daily routines and life responsibilities, it's hard to cover everything. So we decided we would showcase it all in one day in one location and provide the opportunity for attendees to discover and experience everything St. Augustine has to offer.
Get everything in one place at one time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's going to be a lot happening, Jacqueline. This isn't just food and drink, although there will be a lot of that there. What else will people be able to enjoy when they come out to this event?
So we're going to have four main components to the event. We're going to have Made to Taste, which is our tasting area with all our local restaurants. We'll also have Made to Learn, where you can learn about our various activities, such as the Whitney Lab and the Kids Factory and the GTM Reserve, and learn a bit about our heritage and a lot all about the history of St. Augustine. We'll also have a Made for Market area where you'd see all of our local vendors and craftsmen, and our Made for Fun area, which would be our tastings for things such as our local breweries, our distillery, and also, you know, a kids area where you can play in interactive activities.
So the whole idea is as interactive as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And this is the first one, right? Is this the first one?
It is, absolutely.
There's a lot of work that goes into an inaugural event. So
there's a tremendous amount.
Yeah, when it's all over with a much-deserved glass of wine for both of you, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly right, yeah. Now, this is coming up not this weekend, not next weekend, but Sunday, February 11th at Francis Field. And only $5.
$5 to get in.
That's a pretty good ticket.
That's when kids 5 and under are free.
Kids 5 and under are free. And, you know, St. Augustine is just, you know, you can go down anytime and have so much fun. But this is a one-stop opportunity. So, you know, I really think people need to mark their calendar, and live music too. Is it too late for bands to be part of this? Is everything set?
It is. Everything is set at this point. We have, you know, our bands, we have a cocktail competition, we have live cooking demonstrations going on, and all the workshops are set, and all the junior maid stations.
Okay, so already scheduled, but just go to the website madeinstaugustinefest.com to learn more. And mark your calendar for the first ever Made in St. Augustine, Sunday, February 11th at Francis Field, celebrating the nation's oldest city. The festival creators are Monica Bernthal and Jacqueline Zeichner. Thanks for being here. Have fun.
Thanks for having us.
All right. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We're on every day at 9, and our rebroadcast airs every night at 8 p.m. You can also access the podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and our WJCT app. Next on 1A, the shale gas industry is affording America a new independence from a reliance on foreign oil, but at what cost to communities? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Again, our rebroadcast is tonight at 8, and then make sure to keep listening to 89.9 for the State of the Union address. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.